Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast.
Welcome back to Bookbound. I'm Jessica Trotter. I'm joined at the mic by my co-workers, Cheryl Lindemann and Maricela Garza. Hey, ladies.
Hello.
It's June. We are doing this at the first week of June. It's really warm out. It's summer reading is getting ready to go. Actually,
it's
on
today.
It's today.
Summer reading starts.
So
today
we gotta
June 5th.
Talk about that.
Yes. So this is Mari, and I am very excited about our summer reading challenge. It is for adults. It is for teens. It is for kids. It is for babies. It runs all summer. Well, I shouldn't say all summer. It actually runs through August 8th. And you can manage your reading either online through our Beanstack app, or you can pick up a little guide in your branch library. And it's really wonderful because I really love this practice of like just checking off every day that you've read. I got up early this morning around 5:30 and I did my reading. I was so excited to come in and check it off on my guide. We're asking everyone to read anything you want every day, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, 45 minutes, 2 hours, whatever works for you. We really value the practice of reading, and obviously literacy is just so important, especially for our young kids out there getting on in the world, learning about life, and getting ready to start excelling in their older grades. So I really do hope that everyone signs on and chooses to read every day this summer. And maybe even challenge yourself to read extra if you already read every day. So there's also some activities you can do that will contribute towards finishing your goals. Of course, there are prizes, as we like to do here at Capillary District Libraries. There are drawings. There are, and of course, lots of events going on all summer. So, I unearth a story is our theme. Some people think it is dinosaur related. It kind of is because we have a lot of books on dinosaurs on our book list. But really, we're just thinking about what does it mean to unearth different things on the earth or in our minds or bones and fossils and things like that. I am going to start talking about our books. My first book is Rockstar, How Ursula Marvin Mapped Moon Rocks and Meteorites. It's by Sandra Neil Wallace. Ursula Marvin was an American planetary geologist. She was actually the first woman to search for meteorites in Antarctica. And she was someone who just loved being outdoors. She grew up in Vermont, and she collected beetles with her father, who was kind of like the Vermont state expert in bugs, like the bug master or something. And she didn't think she wanted to be a scientist, you know. But she gets to college, and she takes a geology class, which basically changes her life, because she immediately knows that she wants to change her major. And sadly, she is discouraged from changing her major. Like, her professor was like, no, you can't do that. You should be doing more women-like things or whatever. But she, I really liked in the book, she's like, Ursula ignored him. And she just, you know, changed her university. She saw like what she perceived an obstacle. She's like, well, I'm just going to go around that and do that. And I really love that image of like, you know, there are so many things, people, ideas that, you know, try to come against things that we want to do, things that we want to think, and you can go around them and find other ways. And just the way it was portrayed in the book, I really love that. Ursula ignored him. She just went around and did something else. But this is a picture book biography, a very lovely illustration by Nancy Carpenter. There's this scene in the beginning of the book where she's being pulled. She's on skis and she's being pulled by the neighbor's horse. It's really, really beautiful. And there were parts of the book, too, that I thought were quite poetic in that, like, you know, there was blue. There was this ice metaphor, like she found the ice delicious, is, and it's kind of repeated a few different times in the book, like the icy air was delicious, and it's just really beautiful. But in 1978, she gets to Antarctica. She's the only woman on this trip, the first woman. There are photographs in this picture book of her beside her tent, the parka clothes she had to wear. I mean, at that time, I mean, there was no winter wear for Antarctica for women. So she wore men's clothes. It was just super huge. Really, really beautiful book. And I guess I'm really drawn to these books because I want to know about scientists, men and women, who are scientists who are, you know, really pursue their passions. She got her PhD at Harvard, and she has Rocky Ridge in this area of Antarctica where she went called it's called Marvin Nunatak. And Nunatak, I had to look this up, is an isolated peak of rock projecting above a surface of endless inland ice and snow. Marvin also has a crater named after her, which is kind of floating in the air somewhere in that area. So anyway, Rock Star, How Ursula Marvin Mapped Moon Rocks and Meteorites by Sandra Wallace, Neil Wallace.
Very cool. So yes. I really like the way the summer reading program is set up this year, in that it's really creating that habit of just reading every day versus kind of telling people how much time they need to read.
Right. I mean, we always recommend try for 20 minutes if you need a goal, but really you can do whatever you want. You know, for some it might be really 5 minutes or less than that even. But for others, I mean, we're already in the practice of trying to read, you know, an hour or two a day if we can. So I love that it's accessible for everyone.
Right. Yeah. Right. And also I'm diving into the dinosaur thing too, but I will talk about that next time.
Yeah. One of the activities is watch a dinosaur movie. Both Cheryl and I have created movie lists.
And there's lots of lists.
On our catalog.
I'm planning to watch Jurassic Park, which I've never seen. I think we were talking about this earlier this morning.
The jaws are dropped every time she says that.
Yeah. It's like a 30-year-old movie plus. I'm like, I can't wait to see it. And thankfully, thank you, Cheryl, we have it in the system.
And we have the binge box, too, which is a bunch of the movies all together.
Nice. Yep, yep.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so my first book, I'm jumping on the summer fun reading part of this whole thing. And which is a little weird when I get into the explanation, but my first book is actually due out the middle of this month. It's called Dearly Departed by Chip Ponds. I've been sort of on a kick of, it's Pride. I wanted to read LGBTQ stories written by LGBTQ authors. I just wanted to make sure I was going kind of that route this time. And especially, you know, things like I love Heated Rivalry. I have no problems reading Rachel Reed and other authors, but I really wanted to actually, you know, especially when you're talking about male-male romance, having somebody from, you know, who's actually male writing the stories can be, you know, a plus. You should kind of do that too. And I'd heard a lot about Chip Ponds, and I'd never read anything by him. His new book is called Dearly Departed. It is actually, I would kind of call this paranormal romance, though that doesn't have as much. It has some bearing on the story, but not as much as, we're not talking about a suspense story or anything like that. It is actually a somewhat quiet romance. It's in a small town, I think in New Jersey. We have the local funeral home, the person who runs the local funeral home, his name is Hayden Harlow, and we have it's a grumpy sunshine. We have this sunshiny, or at first glance, grumpy sunshine. We have this sunshiny florist a couple doors down who provides sometimes maybe too bright and sunny arrangements for the funerals, so they kind of get off to a weird start, because we have this florist who thinks that, you know, Easter lily, you know, peace lilies are not the only thing you can put in a funeral arrangement, and this very kind of straight-laced funeral director, who actually also happens to be Hades in retirement. This would be the paranormal part of it. So you've got Hades, who's been forcibly retired, who's trying to figure out a loophole in his retirement to maybe go back to what he was, you know, feels more comfortable doing. But in all this time, he's been working as funeral home director in the small town. Then we have Levi, the florist, who is he's got his own issues. They both have issues, and it's part of this is really just sort of figuring out their issues and working together and finding a piece together. It's a sweet story, but it's really about dealing with grief at its heart. It really reminded me, if anybody's read Under the Whispering Door by T.J. Clune, or even I am absolutely blanking the puppet one, In the Lives of Puppets, I think, maybe, close.
I think so, right, yes.
But one of the things that I think is interesting to me about T.J. Clune is that there is a lot of dealing with grief, and he writes profoundly sad scenes that the characters have to work through and work around, and I felt that way with Dearly Departed. It's just both of them have these, in the case of... Levi, it's having lost a sibling and it changing his family dynamic dramatically. With Hayden, it's losing his sense of identity in his previous position and feeling like he's the only one who cares when he has siblings who are out in the world doing their thing. You know, former gods living their lives. Yes, exactly. Cheryl's just laughing. But it is, there's humor, and it is a sweet love story, and I just thought it's a good one to promote. It's a fun one, and I think people would really enjoy it. He's a really good writer, and I'd heard about him, but I hadn't read him before, so I just want people to know about him.
So is the florist just purely human?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So that might be
almost everybody else, siblings, god siblings do show up later in the book, and that is... actually quite funny because they just invite themselves in one night and when they're at home, and that's just so again, this is it's a mix. There's comedy, but there's a lot of angst and really figuring out how to deal with grief in it. So I really enjoyed it. It's Dearly Departed by Chip Ponce.
That makes me think about excuse me, a bit about what Mecca said last month about some of the romances that she was talking about, also having grief and having those serious themes. And I don't know, I am not a romance reader, although I have one on the hold shelf, so I'm very
excited.
Wait a minute,
really?
Yeah, I can't tell you what it is
It's all right.
I'm excited. And there's so much stereotyping about all genres, right?
Oh,
but I don't know that I would have thought that. You know, I don't know that if you think of romance, you think of that. But of course,
it's
full
in
stories
there.
with everything. Yeah.
There's a romance for everybody, honestly.
Yeah, cool. Well, hopefully this won't be for me. I'm very
excited.
There you go. All right. So I'm going to move into my next book. And it is June. It is National Audiobook Month. It is Pride Month, like Jessica mentioned. We like to mention a lot about audiobooks because so many people think still, oh, that's not reading. Or, you know, even for kids, it doesn't count as reading. It absolutely does in every way. It's storytelling. It's the great oral tradition of storytelling, you know, made manifest in a modern way. And, you know, as Jessica knows and Madi knows who purchased the digital ebooks, it's exploded and there's nothing wrong with it. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's so great to be able to multitask with it or focus on it. Some people listen to it at high speed around their house when they're cleaning. I mean, there's so many ways of listening to it. And so I don't listen quite as much because I have a very short commute and I listen to a lot of podcasts. So one that I did listen to about a year ago and I loved, and it's funny because the book that Madi talked about made me think of like our books were communicating, because the word delicious really fits this book for me. It's the prose itself was just witty, funny, a bit satirical, and delicious would be the wording. I just loved listening to this. So it's called Lolly Willows by Sylvia Townsend Warner, and this would be considered also a pride book because Sylvia Townsend Warner was a lesbian, had a longtime partner. The thing about this book that is fascinating is that it was written in 1926, and it was written before Virginia Woolf wrote, just a little bit before, A Room of One's Own. It is an early feminist novel. It's acclaimed that way. Lolly Willows, it's an English novel. Lolly Willows is a woman who lives this very happy life in a country home with her father. And she tends to the garden. She does a lot with herbs. She loves to like play with plants and herbs. Has this great relationship with her father. They're very, very happy. They live in a pretty fancy country house. And then he dies. And she becomes what is called in literature an extra woman. You know, she's basically a woman now who doesn't, she's not married. She doesn't really seek marriage. And she has to go live with family then. And we see this in so many novels, especially English novels. You know, the sisters that go, you know, they're always dependent on the parents. And then they become dependent on the brother or whatever. So she's dependent on the brother. And the brother's very difficult and intense wife. And she, for 20 years, takes care of the nieces and nephews, goes and gets the mail, returns books to the library, makes floral arrangements, you know, just lives this sort of happy-ish life, you know, under the wing of her paternalistic brother. And then at one point, she's in her 40s, she starts to get extremely restless. And she has this encounter, and that's what I'll call it, with a bouquet in the fall in London. And she gets this bouquet, and she brings it home, and the sister-in-law is sort of like, oh, gosh, that's very almost gratuitous. You know, it's so over the top. And she just gets this longing, this like inconsolable longing for this vision of this life in nature, in the countryside, by herself. And she investigates travel guides, and she does it. She goes to a place called Great Mop. And Great Mop is where the adventure begins, and it gets really, really bizarre. It becomes magical realism, maybe even a little bit, like, not horror in a creepy way, but a little bit, you know, paranormal, I guess I would say. And I don't want to say much more about it, but I want to say that it's just the most delicious writing. It's an absolute 100% feminist novel about a woman who didn't have many choices, putting her foot down and making choices, and living for herself. And oddly enough, there's a unique twist. The paternalism kind of stays, though, in its own weird way in the twist. But I'm not going to tell you much more about it. It's a little bit shocking and bizarre, but I highly recommend it. So, Lolly Willows.
Very cool.
Very
cool.
What you got? Okay, so I do have the next book. This is Madi. The Queen's Granddaughter, and this is by Diane Zoller. I'm not sure that I would consider this a feminist book in the same way that we consider feminism today, but then I gotta say, the queens represented in this book were pretty strong women. So this is reimagined historical novel about a 12-year-old who is living her best life in the castle. She's the daughter of a queen and a king in Castile. This is a region of Spain, or what was to later become Spain. And her grandmother, Eleanor, shows up because it's rumored that the grandmother has come to pick the next queen for not her son, but long story long, Queen Eleanor used to be married to the King of France. The King of France dumps her because she didn't give him any sons, but she reclaims her power and marries the King of England. Okay, that's the long part.
This is Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Yes, Eleanor of Aquitaine. But she has, there's a prince in France, and she wants her family to be aligned with France again. So she comes to Castile to pick the queen, which is a practice among the royalty at that time. And we're talking 1122 ish to 1204. This is a long, long time ago. And, you know, the 12-year-old girl is Blanche, or Blanca. She doesn't want her sister, who is the person who's supposed to go off with the grandmother to become queen of France, to go. So she starts kind of down, kind of talking, like, you know, she doesn't really speak very good French, and she's really shy and awkward in big crowds. She wouldn't make a good leader. And the next thing you know, Queen Eleanor has decided to take Blanche or Blanca on to France to become the queen. And she's like, no, that's not what I wanted. But she's forced to do this because this is a family obligation. And, you know, we still see these sort of things today in royalty. We don't have that experience much in the U.S., but just reading the news about, like, other countries where there's royalty still in existence, like, all the expectations placed on people, that's really kind of wild. But anyway, this book is really set as, a bit of an adventure because they're going on horseback all the way back to France from Castile. And there's, there's weather, there's storms, there, you know, time spent in caves. There are, I wouldn't say bandits, but really soldiers from the military that are like, hey, let's take advantage of this situation. And, they imprison them. Queen Eleanor at one time was imprisoned by her husband. Mm-hmm. And it's, very listed, even though she's, kind of portrayed as a very formidable woman in this children's middle grade novel, that's something that always, like, really haunted her, is that she was locked up. So it's a really nice book, kind of reimagining, of course, the history of that time period, but also the, there's a friend that Blanche gets to take with her. Her name is Sana, and she's an Almohad, or at that time, someone who worshipped Allah, and just like the differences and the similarities in their faith at that time, and how she was affected by hearing loss. I love the names back then. Blanca's sisters, Urraca and Berenguela, they helped to develop this hand language, like a precursor to sign language, to help Sana communicate. It's just a fascinating, fascinating book. So I hope there will be some middle grade readers out there and adults who will pick it up.
Yeah, it's very neat. It's funny to hear it kind of from that perspective, because for other people who might recognize Eleanor Aquitaine was the mother of Richard and John.
Yes, yes.
So it's
yes.
Richard Lionheart and
yeah.
John, who was forced to join the Magna Carta. So
the realities of political marriages, I don't know. It seems
dramatic.
It's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
It is interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, there are not that many books for kids set with this type of time period.
I mean, I'm thinking of all those, Netflix series or Hulu series of mostly in my,
consume.
Yeah. Pardon?
AVI?
Yeah.
That's about all I can
remember. Karen Cushman touches on with some of them, like Catherine Called Birdie and that sort of thing.
Right, yeah.
This just historical, even if, it is a reimagining, of course,
but it's very
kind
neat.
Of these medieval times, I think, really appeal to some children, and I wanted to bring it
absolutely.
To the podcast for that reason. And
I ended up in a history major.
Blanca is a really strong person and really getting ready to take on her destiny, I guess, as the queen of France later.
It's very neat.
Wow. Well, moving into the present now from these last books, this is a book that was published this year. I believe that one was too, right? The one that you just mentioned. It's 2026. Is that a 2026?
Yes, this was released in 2026.
Okay. So. A couple years ago, was it even? Maybe just two. Sarah Novick wrote a very, very highly acclaimed book called True Biz.
Yep.
It's about Reese's. 2 years ago or so. Yeah.
It's a Reese's pick.
A Reese's pick. It was on our end of year best books list, from what I recall, about a deaf school.
Residential deaf school.
Okay. So I had not read that, but it just sounded really good. You can only read so many books, right? Sometimes you just don't get to them. But when I saw this one, Mother Tongue, this is her memoir, I knew that I needed to pick it up. So it was just released, and wow. I just want to say, sometimes, especially if you read a lot of books, you learn things. You're like, okay, I learned something. But this is one of those books that was it's like a paradigm shift or like a reading moment where you feel like you've been changed. Because the information, it is a memoir, but the information presented in it, it's very rich with historical detail, with detail about being a deaf person right now, being a deaf person historically. the lack of positive changes and some technologies that are making things worse for people in the deaf community. It is very immersive. It was beautifully written. And I just, I really feel changed by this book, and my mind just completely opened up. But at the other sense, it's a story of being a mother, and it's a mother to a biological child who, you know, Sarah Novick is deaf. She didn't really accept being deaf until she was about a teenager or so, is when she really started learning sign and opening up this whole different world. She tried to hide it, tried to cope with different ways. And this is one of those books where there's so much going on here. There's the story of her biological child who was born not deaf. As a story, a really beautiful and complicated and very respectful story of international adoption, touching on some of the extreme ills of international adoption, some of the crimes that were involved in international adoption and the wrongs of it, and the decision to still do it anyway. Her husband was internationally adopted, and they adopted a deaf child from Thailand. So there's that story. He had no language at all. He really could not hear well enough to accept even the Thai words that were shouted literally in his ear. One of the most beautiful parts of the book is when they adopt him and they're in the hotel, and it's really awkward, right? I mean, you adopt this baby and you're like, I'm your parent, hello, and you're trying to make it comfortable, and it's just very intense. And they start teaching him a teeny bit of sign, and he picks it up right away. And it's the most beautiful, moving paragraph in the book. But I'm jumping around because there's so much and I don't know what to cover. I really think you just need to pick it up and read it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the history of eugenics,
yep,
of Alexander Graham Bell, who is not the, you know, we all learn. What do we learn in school? He invented the telephone. He was also someone who wanted to eradicate deaf people.
Mm. Yeah.
And didn't want them to marry, wanted them to be hidden. And just this huge fight against, really, to boil it down, against sign, against signing, mm-hmm, and this favoritism towards oralism in all sorts of areas, especially in education. Yeah. So
And that still, I think, happens today with parents. Like, I talked on the podcast, it was a YA title a while back, Show Me a Sign by, I think it's Anna Sortino.
Yeah.
And just, like, parents who either fear or just don't want their kids to be as normal, in quotes, as possible. Yeah. So they want to discourage them from getting into that world. I also wanted to mention, if you don't mind, there is a fabulous video short film, The Silent Child. It was the Academy Award winner short film in 2017, I think. We do still have it. It's on Canopy, so you'd have to stream it. But it was amazing. I think the setting is in Britain or in England somewhere, and just same story where there's a child whose parents do not want her to learn signing. They would rather that she try to adapt, and there's someone, a teacher, who comes into her life and, you know, really changes her world when she begins to communicate with her through sign.
There's that's touched on quite a bit as far as those choices, and part of it is the institutions and the systems and the way that people assisting parents and making the decisions. There's also the side of all the technologies. There's some gene therapy that can, not fully, but cure deafness. So there's that too, and those pressures on parents to make those decisions. And there's a statistic from this that 90% of deaf children are born to hearing parents. And only 8% of those parents learn sign language, which is a completely full language. Mm-hmm. It's complete. It expresses emotions that her adopted son couldn't even express until he had the language to express them. Mm-hmm. So just a really powerful book. I don't want to say much more about it because you got to read
and
it
I've
and experience
started it.
It.
It's something she's a very good writer. I really enjoyed what I read. It very much reminds me of, I think I've talked about Raymond Antrobus a couple of times here.
Oh, yeah.
His The Quiet Ear.
Yes.
There was a point where I was asking Cheryl about where I read different parts because it's either in his book or it was in the beginning of her book. And also I mean, even something more popular like Deputopia.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that there is more books coming out on this topic. So
I agree.
Real owned voices discussion in the positive sense.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Oh, so important. Another book that sort of cracked my world open a long time ago was in 2003 when it came out was Persepolis, The Story of a Childhood by Marjane Satrapi. And I was always championing this book. If you were a patron at any of the branches where I was a branch head.
I think I read it because you recommended it when I was at Mason.
That's funny because one of my friends and colleagues said the same thing. And I don't remember even recommending it to her. It was always on my staff picks.
Yep.
But very tragically, Marjane Satrapi did die yesterday, June 4th, June 3rd?
Within the last 2 days, yes.
At 56 years old and extremely young. And so there's a lot of tributes right now to her. I went back last night and I had never seen the movie that was based off of Persepolis 1 and Persepolis 2. Mm-hmm. Watched that last night. We do have that in the collection, so I'll link that into the show notes. If you haven't experienced this book yet, please check it out or check out the movie. It is it's a window into the very complicated, remaining very complicated situation of life and politics in Iran. So it's the Iranian, the fall of the Shah, the Iranian Islamic Revolution, and the Iran-Iraq War. And the Persepolis is the first book, is her life as a child growing up in this context. Mm-hmm. With very kind of activist parents, and then I won't say much more about it. You really have to experience it. I was not a huge graphic novel person, and it just knocks you over.
It was one of the first graphic novels I read as a librarian. That's for sure.
And it's very accessible.
Ago, but yeah,
I feel like it's a lot.
I remember ever people not into graphic novels.
Yeah.
All kind of coming around.
Right. So. And just tells that story in this it's so emotional and it's so difficult, but a sad day when we saw that news in the morning that she was gone. So check out her. She has a lot of other excellent books too that we have in the system.
I'm going to swing back around to the audiobook comments and questions and my next pick I listen to. I am at that point that every downloadable audiobook user gets to, and I think Madi, as we've discussed this within the last week as well, everything comes at once, and I'm trying to, and everything goes away right before I finish. So there's a book I thought I would be talking about that I'll be talking about next month, but instead, because I lost it with 2 hours to go on it, which is, I broke my heart because I really wanted to finish it. But I would like to talk about, I've been wanting to talk about this one anyway, so Picky, How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. This is a book by Helen Zoe Veit, who is an MSU professor. This is, I believe, her first book. It is extremely well-researched if you actually pick up the written copy. A good chunk of the book is actually just her footnotes. And they're amazing. But it is a really interesting exploration of how we went from let's just have everybody eat the same food, or which was influenced by the there's not enough food around, we're just all eating the same food. So a favorite meal for a New England boy in the 1850s, and all the chapters have this a little menu notes. This is a favorite meal of a New England boy in the 1850s, baked beans, codfish cakes, corned beef, salt pork, turnips, cabbage, onions, and mince pie. Mm. And then you move into 1936 school lunch menu, meatloaf, whole wheat bread and butter, prunes, canned fruit, cocoa.
There are a lot of prunes in that book.
There were a lot of prunes in that book. Then you get to the 1950s. In the 1950s, you get Kellogg's Variety Pack commercial, rice raisin bran for the mother, Pep for the father, corn flakes for the brother, and Rice Krispies for the little sister. It's just, you know, having grown up a kid who was always considered picky, I get a very interesting view of the commercial food, big pharma, a little bit of everything. There's some really interesting looks at the influence of Dr. Spock. And another person I wasn't aware of, a woman named Clara Davis, who was a researcher here in Michigan, who did some very interesting studies on what children would eat in a closed situation if you gave them a range of foods, what they would pick. But everybody took this and ran with it with the idea that leave kids alone, they'll eat what's best for them. And but she was like, no, this is just a menu of healthy options. They just took it as whatever's on the table, that they don't need to eat what you're eating, get them something else. It's a very interesting, she just traces the change of the mindset, and it's just very, very interesting. And it doesn't, one of the things it doesn't go into is the change in foods and the makeup of food and whether, GMOs or what else has added to things or tastes of food, but it is very, very, it's a very moving argument to sort of see the development of how this has changed in history. So it was really interesting.
Yeah, sounds really good.
And I would highly recommend it. And again, MSU professor and very, very much used the Special Collections at MSU has a cool, large cookbook culinary collection, a historical collection that she used. And I mean, lots of other places too, but I knew that existed. So yeah. I was kind of looking for that in the notes and in the book. And she talks about it. So again, this is Picky, How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History by Helen Zoe Veit.
Sounds great.
Great audio. She read the audio. She did really well. It was good.
Very cool.
Want to talk about?
Okay, so I think I have the last book.
No, it's not the last book.
It's not the last book. Okay, sorry.
Still want to talk about one
not
more?
Not quite. Okay. The Mystery of the Stolen World Cup Trophy by Angela Cervantes. Okay, so I'm someone who doesn't really follow sports very much, but apparently there's this big thing coming in like just a few days called the FIFA something or other World Cup.
Wow, sports ball. Okay.
Yeah, I like, you know, follow baseball because of my mother, but not really anything else. Well, except for some MSU sports. But anyway, this is a little fascinating mystery book because it's about a child, a middle grader. His name is Diez Espada, and I love how he starts the book. He's like, who names their kid after a number? Diez, in case anybody doesn't know, is the number 10 in Spanish. And he's like the culprit numero uno. My dad, his name is Nueve. Well, that's a joke, actually. My mom's name, his name is Jaime. But it's just, this is the kind of humor he starts out with. Like, he's just kind of kidding around a lot. And that's what this book really is. In many ways, it's kind of ridiculous. But there are so many jokes in it. Diez is someone who really loves mysteries. And he's not as big into like football and soccer as like his dad would like him to be, but he can take it. He definitely has his stars, that he would like to meet. There's a lot of name dropping of, Lionel Messi and other soccer stars. But this is set in Miami, and he is like, he considers himself, in training to be a detective. And he's it starts off with like, somebody in their school stole the school mascot costume, which is Louis the Lobster. So, so he's devised this way to like, catch the culprit. And in a roundabout way, it turns out to be someone he kind of has a crush on, but really quickly determines that he's really annoyed with Rio. Her mother is like a telenovela star. There's a ton of references to Spanish language sorts of things. So you see a lot of that in the story. Empanadas, Ay Dios mío, Qué tonto, which I'm not sure if I like that one very much. H is for hermosa. That's like saying B is for beauty. And these are like corny things that his dad says. Oh. But this is... We talked about grief earlier. I noticed that in a lot of Y, or J and Y books lately, that there are a lot of themes of grief. And I'm not sure if it's those are the books I'm picking up, or maybe there is a real push to explore those themes more so in youth literature. But he's lost his mother recently, who was a librarian. But he shared in common with her a love of mystery. So that kind of is his reason for becoming a detective. Nice. But he's very slowly moving into a more cordial friendship with this Rio person who stole Louis the lobster costume, because Rio, who's really wealthy, drops a ticket for him and his father to attend a special party, a FIFA party, where the trophy's going to be there, all these, you know, supposed rock stars from that universe, and the trophy goes missing. Oh, no. A ton of references to Agatha Christie, as well as other sorts of mysteries. It's a really cute read. I think it will go quickly, and that middle grade readers should give it a try.
Very cool. Okay.
Yeah, awesome. Speaking of quickly, I'm going to talk about one lightning fast. It's called On Life, Death, and Little Women, the March Sisters. This is a literary criticism mixed with memoir about... One essay is each one of the sisters in Little Women, and there's some fantastic authors, Kate Bolick, Jenny Zhang, Carmen Maria Machado, and Jane Smiley. I have to say my favorite essays were Carmen Maria Machado, who does Beth, and Jane Smiley, who does Amy. You get a lot about the real Alcott sisters, not just the ones, you know, portrayed in Little Women. Lizzie as Beth, the real child was Lizzie, and May was the real Amy. And those two essays, to me, are really standouts. There's personal story mixed in with a literary criticism. So if you don't want that, you might not like it. But it's really, really a good book.
I love Carmen Maria Machado.
Yeah. It's excellent. Talks a lot about illness. That's what hers is about. And the essay about Amy really pulls Amy from into the real May was really fascinating and was almost as accomplished, honestly, as Louisa May Alcott. So, but maybe people don't know that. And so it's just really fascinating. It talks about her as probably the most feminist, fully fleshed feminist of all the characters. So it's a really unique take. And just aside, speaking with my daughter about Little Women, Amy is her favorite character. And it's funny because growing up, of course, it was like Joe is supposed to be your favorite. Yeah. But all the kids in her peer group, Amy was their favorite. And I think that's really, really interesting, especially after reading this essay, because, you know, we're farther away from when I first was exposed to these characters.
Yeah. Right.
And so there's maybe something to think about there. And Jane Smiley really hits the nail on the head about why. Not even really touching on the fact that young people might be fascinated by Amy. But
Yeah, I was really fascinated by Beth. That she's my favorite character. But as I'm hearing you speak, I'm like, is it because I really liked her character in the book? Or is it because I'm enjoying all the reimaginings of Little Women and how they portray her. So I'm like, I really have to think about that.
Yep.
Yeah. So.
Okay. All right. I think I have the last book, actually. I'm going back again. We were bouncing around, but again, this is Pride. This is audiobook month. I have sports-related themes, and I do watch sports. I want to talk about Let Us Play by Harrison and Rachel Brown, who are siblings. Harrison Brown was a successful forward in women's hockey, played for the NWHL, won two Isabel Cups before retiring to transition. He's actually kind of all over the place right now. He is a LGBTQ advocate. He's an actor. He's a writer and producer. They put this book out last year. It's Let Us Play, Winning the Battles for Gender Diverse Athletes. They do a lot of in-depth study into how various legislation is affecting not just trans athletes, but female athletes, male athletes in general, and it really makes a solid case against persecuting a very, very small percentage of players in a way that's going to affect everybody. Just let them play. It's really well done. It is, I listened to it as an audiobook. It is read by Harrison. And they just, they talk about a variety of different athletes who, you know, have played and it's not been an issue, or played and then suddenly it's an issue. And it's just a very interesting and detailed look into what scientific studies exist, how they're being fully ignored, how it's willfully, you know, people, a lot of the people arguing against transgender athletes have no interest in the sports in general. And it's just a political thing that is being done. So it's one of those things that I highly recommend. Again, Harrison's sort of all over the place. He had a small part in Heated Rivalry in the television series. I really personally have, having read all the books, I sort of hoped he would be a character that appears later in the series, who I don't know if that person was inspired by him, but there's he was the first out transgender player to win a major, it was the Isabel Cup, but, you know, win a major championship on a team and be an out player. And, you know, he put off transitioning medically until he retired, but everybody knew. It's just, I just thought it was a well done look at the issues and would highly recommend it.
That come out this year?
Actually, I think end of last year.
Okay.
Okay. It's Let Us Play, Winning the Battle for Gender Diverse Athletes by Harrison Brown and Rachel Brown. And Rachel is a journalist, so okay. It's his sister. So.
All right. So, excellent.
Wow.
Everybody go out and enjoy summer reading.
Read whatever you want.
And happy Pride and happy Audiobook Month.
Yes.
And all the other things.
Happy June.